session number 17596, reel 1.
I was born in Colchester in Essex in 1946, on the 4th of June.
Can you tell me, first of all, about your duties and your rank when the Falklands War broke out, please?
Yes, I was in command of 820 Squadron, which was a seeking squadron, a new aircraft type, in fact, or mark of aircraft, the Mark V, which was a rather sophisticated passive warfare primary helicopter for and submarine warfare, that is. And I'd been in command since June the previous year, and at the time we were alongside in Portsmouth as the squadron embarked.
Did the outbreak of the crisis take you completely by surprise?
I don't think completely by surprise, but certainly by surprise, yes. And if I remember rightly, the time I got the message, I was at home. And it was, I think, the 2nd of April, and I think had it been the day before and I received the telephone call from my senior pilot, I might have responded slightly differently to what I did. But I think we were aware that there was trouble in the South Atlantic, but nevertheless the speed of developments was slightly surprising.
What kind of role was the Sea King supposed to carry out in circumstances like this?
Well, primarily our job was anti-submarine warfare, but as I mentioned when we started, the aircraft type that I had was primarily orientated against the nuclear submarine, and our method of detection was using passive means. But of course, anti-submarine warfare, as it became in the South Atlantic, against a wholly conventional threat, was rather different than what we'd in the main been practicing during the previous year. So our primary mission was to be anti-submarine warfare, but inevitably a lot of surface surveillance and trying to help provide the picture for the command of the fleet, and a number of other secondary roles, such as replenishment, delivery of this, that and the other, would also undoubtedly come into play. That was the expectation. Having said that, of course, that if one looks back into history, and I was aware of it at the time, the anti-submarine aircraft, helicopters certainly, have almost invariably ended up doing military support duties in the end, and so it happened to us.
How many Sea Kings were there in the squadron?
I had 9 aircraft in the squadron, but it was augmented by a further 2 aircraft at the moment of sailing.
Once you got the news of the outbreak of the conflict, what happened to you then?
Well, in some ways it was fortuitous that the ship and squadron embarked, just returned from Norway, where we'd been doing an Arctic exercise, and we were in Portsmouth, and only planning to be there for a fairly short time, I think a period of 2.5-3 weeks. And I had decided that rather than do what we would normally do, which was to disembark the squadron down to our parent air station in Cornwall, Caldres, to actually keep the aircraft on board and to take leave from the ship. And I managed to persuade people this was a good idea, because if they went, did it that way, they would get more leave. So when actually the recall happened, the problem was really comparatively simple for us. It was just getting ourselves back on board the ship, and we were ready to go really quite quickly, and it was just a matter of receiving all the additional stores and equipment that we were being given for this operation, whereas other squadrons of course had to embark themselves as well as gather their people together, and that of course meant getting the aircraft out of the hangars to fly them on board from the parent air station. So that particular stage was actually not a great problem. It was just a matter of getting people back from their holidays and Central Europe skiing or whatever.
Did you at that stage believe personally that there would be fighting?
Funnily enough, I did, and I remember one occasion. I was ashore buying one or two things one afternoon, and I ran into the ship's operations officer, and we went off and had a drink together, and we both concluded that this was likely to be, well, I think we phrased at the time, a bloody occasion. Mind you, I think that opinion was held by very few on board.
Did you view the prospect of going down to the South Atlantic and being in action there with dismay or excitement or what?
I can't say excitement, apprehension certainly. I had had a small amount of experience in the Far East during the Indonesian confrontation in gunboats and active service, so it wasn't totally a new thing to me. And I think, by and large, there were very few people in the ship who'd had any experience, and I think it was only the captain who'd served in Korea and, of course, in the Far East, who was really experienced in combat, as it were. So I viewed it with a certain amount of apprehension, certainly not excitement. And it was interesting to watch other people as we went through the various stages, pre-departure and post-departure, in our preparation, not least in our own personal attitudes towards whatever was going to happen.
What happened next?
After embarking, as I said, we were ready to go effectively on the Saturday morning, I think, and we then had to wait for Hermes, who had come from a long way back. She was, I think, at the time not operational. She hadn't worked up. We were a fully worked up ship, and so she needed to consider more preparation over that weekend, and I think the decision was made that we would sail together, which we did, of course, on Monday. So during the weekend, there was a certain amount of time off for my people because they were fully prepared and the aircraft were all ready to go. And I had, amongst my 50 officers, a number of rather talented songwriters and singers, and so there business was to actually go and rewrite some of Lloyd Webber's lyrics to suit the occasion, which they went off and sang around some of the pubs in Portsmouth. And that, I think, reflected the initial attitude of many, that it was a sort of rather jingoistic and certainly excited mood, which was certainly going to sober up in the days and weeks to come. But it was interesting to observe the initial reaction by some of my squadron officers.
Do you remember any of the lyrics? Can you quote any?
I wouldn't dare try and quote them. Not that they were bad lyrics at all. Indeed, quite polite, but I don't remember them well enough to be able to recite them to you now.
And when you sailed on the Monday?
For myself, I was actually in my cabin and in the briefing room preparing to fly. So I missed actually what I gathered afterwards was a fairly momentous occasion and a very large send-off from the people who'd come down to the waterfront of Old Portsmouth to see the ships out. And I think that occasion perhaps impressed upon us just what the gravity of the situation was and the importance of it. And I think that was a striking occasion for most people who witnessed this, and I heard about it immediately after the ship sailed. But for me, I was in the sky within half an hour or so of sailing.
Did you have any problems at first? Any problems that you personally had to deal with?
I think it was no enormous problems. It was mainly focusing on your people and trying to look ahead and seeing what we might need in terms of support facilities. I think most people knew where the Falklands were, but not everybody really hoisted in just quite how far away they were and how really communications were going to be extremely difficult. And I think one of the things that struck me at an early stage was the need to have a fairly good support system back at home to actually relay the messages as they came through and interpret what was going on to the families we left behind. Because I think, unlike many conflicts of the recent past, actually trying to get information back was actually quite... there wasn't a regular flow. Even the press, as we recall, were only able to get back reports by signal, certainly in the early stages. There was no television coverage in the early stage. And I think it was quite important for the people who were in my squadron to feel that actually their people, our families, were being well looked after and being given sensible information rather than misinformation which would upset them. So it was things like that what I was thinking about at that particular stage, and then beginning to plan how you were going to bring up your proficiency and expertise to peak at the moment when you might be asked to do something.
Can you take me through the voyage south, step by step, as you remember it, please?
Well, I think after we sailed, as I said, I was in the sky about half an hour afterwards, and the ship had gone to flying stations. And I think quite remarkably, she stayed at flying stations for another 75 days, which was an extremely long time. And I think if you look at her period at sea, it was the longest period a carrier of the Western world had been at sea conducting operations forever. Going south, initially we went and sat off the southwest of England and picked up some more people and some more stores, but that only lasted for a day or so, and then we all sailed on together towards Ascension Island. As I mentioned just now, one of the things was trying to get a sort of graduated response to the situation. There was a temptation to go immediately to battle stations, to use a colloquial word, but of course the threat was a very long way away, and it was going to be a good 3 weeks before we were actually going to get to a stage where we could possibly engage or be engaged by the enemy. And so on the way down for my squadron, it was really an opportunity to start progressing those skills which perhaps, because we were facing a different sort of enemy potentially than the one we'd actually been used to in the Cold War scenario, and adjusting these skills to be able to deal with their particular capabilities. And this really demanded quite a lot of work, because suddenly we were facing threats from weapon systems, some of which we'd actually built in UK ourselves, but a lot of them are very different to the sort of weapon systems that we've been used to thinking about as opposition in the old East-West conflict. And so there was that. And that was obviously, one of those was the Exocet missile, which was something we really hadn't, I don't think, at that stage really addressed, certainly in terms of an opposition. But also for my people, they also needed to start thinking about how to survive in the face of fighter aircraft attacking them, which is something I think in the past we, in my particular specialisation, we hadn't considered an enormous threat, because by and large we were used to operations on the high seas and away from the sort of fighter aircraft who are likely to have a go at you in and around coastal waters. So it was all this sort of business that we were attending to, as well as just getting people up to a high state of proficiency generally. But then I think we were lucky in so much that we were fully worked up and actually we had the time, therefore, to devote to these sort of additional skills.
So what was the plan should you come across fighter aircraft?
Well, it was really just developing the technique. So if you suddenly find yourself being attacked by a fighter aircraft and a helicopter, there are certain things you can do to make sure that you still remain in the air, but it is a technique, and it's something that needs to be practiced. And basically what you do is you produce a crossing rate for the aircraft just at the moment he's going to engage. So you basically move yourself out of his sight at a time when he can't manoeuvre and is committed to his attack run. It's this sort of thing. Very simple in principle, but actually it needs a good deal of practice if you want to get it right. And if you don't fly the aircraft in a particular way, if you try and throw the aircraft around too hard, i.e. in a very severe manner, then you'll find the aircraft won't fly at the speed you want, and you will actually make the problem a lot easier for the attacking aircraft, because you'll slow your own aircraft down and not produce a crossing rate through being too severe on the controls. So it's techniques.
So how much did you need to know about the kind of aircraft which the Argentinians would deploy against you?
A lot, and also about their submarines. And I think we hadn't naturally focused on them before. We knew a certain amount about their ships and aircraft because we knew them from the past, or indeed they might have been bought in the UK. Their submarines, their two main submarines, were two very small, what we call 109s, which were going to be a formidable opponent. Not fast, but actually very quiet, very difficult to detect, and particularly in a South Atlantic Ocean, which has an awful lot of marine life in it. And to this day, I don't think anybody can lay their hands on their heart and say without any doubt that we ever had contact on one of these submarines, but I think there were a number of occasions where we may well have done.
What means of detecting the submarines did you have?
Well, we were using active sonar, which, as I say, was not our principal as we've been practicing in the past. But passive sonar buoys against a very small submarine are very unlikely to be effective, or you've got to be so close to the submarine to detect it.
So you were telling me about the journey south towards Ascension Island.
Yes, I mean, it was a sort of slow progress of not basically adjusting people's minds to the thought of what was to come and preparing them for it. It was not, as I say, a business of actually taking away all immediate creature comforts and going immediately to a sort of battle state, because I think one of the important things was we found was to actually make sure that people were as fit as they could be. And this posed some quite interesting problems for my squadron, whose concept of operations was to fly around the clock. We had to look at what procedures for things like what would happen when the ship went to action stations for, say, a missile attack. Would you get everybody out and close them up, as carriers used to do in the last World War, some with disastrous effect? Or would you allow them to remain in those who were off watch or not flying or maintained as domestics, to stay in their cabins domestics? Because if you got them up, basically you were going to run out of people fairly shortly to continue this 24-hour about flying program, which went on right until the end of June. So that was 3 months solid, this continuous flying. And normally we worked on having three aircraft on task the whole time, so you'd just be rippling these. But of course, that demands a tremendous amount of effort to keep it going for a prolonged period. So if you interrupt the process by taking people out of that off flying periods or off maintaining periods for very long, you just run out of steam. So it became, I think, subsequently quite an experience to be lying on your bunk awake listening to the principal warfare officer telling you all about how your ship was under attack from missiles or whatever.
What happened once you got to Ascension?
Well, when we arrived at Ascension, there were a number of other high power people who came out to discuss the plan. The Commander Chief came out, but for us, what we principally observed and participated in was this tremendous logistics operation. The Air Force had been flying out VC-10s and C-130s full of ammunition and all sorts of stores. And so we sat off, the task force sat off Ascension, I think for about 3 days, just taking on all these stores, which was mainly, if not entirely, done by helicopters. So we had this stream of helicopters going around the fleet, and I think it was a chain of about 20-odd aircraft bringing out tons and tons of stores and ammunition. And that, as I say, went on for the weekend. And then we sailed in rather a hurry, I think on the Monday morning, so we're talking about now about the third weekend, I suppose, in April, because somebody, I think what had happened, a tanker had detected on radar or visually, I don't recall which, a periscope, or thought they had, which had been subsequently confirmed by a sonar of another ship as a contact headed south rather rapidly. Anyway, the upshot of all this was that the fleet sails in a hurry, and I think we potentially then went on a war footing in Invincible. I think we'd probably been in defensive watches by then, or if not, we certainly had gone into defensive watches by then, and so we were in the final stages of preparation. Also, the Argentinians were sending up a Boeing 707 as a reconnaissance aircraft, and that, I think, started to feature on the scene around about that stage, or just slightly after, as we left Ascension. So Ascension was a fairly short, highly busy 2 or 3 days of taking on the final surprise.
Did you personally think that enemy submarines might be encountered so far north?
Not enemy. My own feeling was that that wasn't likely to be an Argentinian submarine, though they were fairly short-range, small submarines. But it could well have been a rather bigger nation interested in what was going on.
And then, once you were into the southern hemisphere?
Well, we'd been flying throughout the period up into the Ascension, but of course we then steadied down into effectively a state of high tension that we hadn't actually, of course, gone to war by this stage. We were providing continuous screen around the force as we went south for anti-submarine warfare, as well as surface surveillance.
What happened next?
Well, I think we had one or two contacts on the way down, which I have no doubt were not submarines at all. As I mentioned before, there was a tremendous amount of marine life in the South Atlantic, and more than we've been used to in anti-submarine warfare operations in the past. And therefore it took actually quite a long time for people to get to settle down and get used to the environment which they were operating in. And indeed it became a feature of the South Atlantic operation. Whenever a new ship arrived down, or a new group of ships, you would then suddenly find the number of incidents would increase, because as they reported what they thought was proper contact, especially probably marine life. I mean, it did take people 3 or 4 days to actually settle down and get used to the environment they were working in, particularly underwater environment. So that continued on till we got, I think, to the end of April, about the 31st, when we sat outside what had become the recently made exclusion zone. I think on the way down, we were all obviously thinking very deeply about what might happen, and there were a number of considerations. Of course, General Haig was doing his shuttle across the Atlantic, and the Prime Minister seemed to be as determined as ever. And I think, actually, I always reflect that people fought as they did, not least because we had a female Prime Minister. And I think there was no doubt in our minds, it's like men of the female species, when they say they want something doing, they jolly well mean it, and we might as well get on and do it. And the last thing we wanted was to find ourselves, I speak very personally, but there were a number of people who shared my opinion, to find ourselves sitting off on a siege basis throughout a winter, or indeed to be put in a position of sort of, not stalemate, but frozen and unable to progress further south, or not be able to return north. I mean, that is, of course, notwithstanding the possibility that there might have been a political settlement, but that became increasingly unlikely. And so there was that sort of thought as to what was going on. So I think that by this stage, and we're talking about a few days out from Ascension onwards, people were pretty keen to get on with it, because I think we got this sort of feeling, as I used to try and describe, that the sooner we got down there and got it done, got back, the sooner we'd get home. And since we were going into winter down there, of course, it was not going to be a pleasant experience, not least of which we were missing summer in the Northern Hemisphere.
And then, once you reach the exclusion zone?
Well, then, I think it was a Saturday evening, we heard the news that we were going to go into the zone the following day. And that, of course, was effectively, as far as we could see, going to be the time which we were going to meet the opposition. And I was in the wardroom, I think, that evening when my captain addressed the ship's company, which was actually rather a remarkable occasion, because he used clear circuit television to do it. And there'd been a broadcast around the ship that he would be addressing the ship's company at whatever time. So we all gathered into the wardroom, as I'm sure the sailors gathered around that television sets and domestics and elsewhere. And he ran through how he saw the opposition and how he saw our own forces and relative capabilities. And we all paid attention. And this went on for about, I suppose, about 15 minutes or so. And then right at the end of this, whether he thought about this before or not, I know not, but he suddenly said, "Well, that's about it then. Frankly, I think we're pissed. Good night." And it had the most remarkable effect. I think in morale terms, people suddenly sort of thought, right, this is the way we're going. And it dispelled perhaps a lot of the nervousness and apprehension that people were feeling by just that sort of a rather sort of sailor's type of remark, but nevertheless just met the moment. And and I think exposed our captain as being the captain for the occasion. And I think the role of command, which I personally found myself, takes on a very different aspect when you get into operational combat.
Had you by that stage had to do anything regarding the morale of your own unit?
Oh yes, I think one was constantly aware of morale, indeed before I sailed, because amongst the jingoism that I described earlier, undoubtedly individuals were extremely concerned about what might happen. And I had 200 people in my squadron. And I think that it was an unusual operation in so much that it was obviously going to be quite a big operation from the outset, but it wasn't a sort of operation where you were back to the cliffs of Dover defending your country. You were going out to do a sort of a surgical precision operation, and therefore you had to start thinking about people in a slightly different way than you might in another occasion. I mean, the value of people and how you use them, and indeed the sacrifice of people. And so all this sort of wove itself into the thought process about morale. One of the first instances I had was because I had in my squadron a member of the royal family, and that was quite interesting because there was no doubt in my mind that there could be those people elsewhere who were thinking perhaps this wasn't quite such a good thing for him to participate in. But as far as I was concerned, it was absolutely crucial that he was with us when we sailed, because of the effect of the morale on the rest of my organisation, indeed not the ship. So that was quite interesting, and that led to one or two interesting conversations with him about what might happen and how we might alleviate the situation for him.
Is it possible to say what the conversation...
Well, I think our conversation was very, very straightforward to him. That, as far as I was concerned, as his commanding officer, he was there to be a pilot, and he should come. And I think he felt that too. But like anybody, he was feeling pretty apprehensive about it. I think that I may have laid it on a bit thick and said that, of course, well, if we get to the stage at which it all becomes rather real.